Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
Hi there, and welcome again to the Explaining History podcast. I'm going to talk tonight about a period of the Second World War that gets very little attention, and it is the British campaigns, really the Indian Army campaigns in Iraq. And the reason why I think this is important to look at is, firstly, it shows the kind of the shaky state of the British Empire in 1940-1941, the vulnerability of Britain and its communications between its Asian empire and the Mediterranean. It shows you the importance of oil and the importance of the continuing strategic and geopolitical importance of Iraq. That had been the product of kind of British post-war machinations, and obviously has continued to be an object of kind of Western interference and colonialism, and the bloodshed and violence that's brought with it into the 21st century. I'm looking at an excellent book. I've mentioned it before, Srinath Raghavan's India's War, The Making of Modern South Asia, 1939-45. Really good from a whole host of ways. Very interesting, part social history, part military history, which is what I think great military history books can be. Srinath Raghavan writes, "An erstwhile province of the Ottoman Empire, Iraq had been occupied by Britain during the First World War. The Indian Army had played an important role in its conquest. Nearly 675,000 Indian troops had been deployed in Iraq, and although the Indian Army had suffered a humiliating defeat at Kut al-Amara in 1916, obviously the Indian Army, with British soldiers as well, was besieged at Kut. It was sent up the Tigris River, besieged at Kut, and trapped there, and the surviving prisoners were treated appallingly by the Turkish army. After its defeat at Kut, it had gone on to occupy the country. After the war, Iraq was administered by Britain as a League of Nations mandated territory. The outbreak of a major rebellion in 1920 had led London to turn again to India for its troops. Eventually, the country was granted independence under the Anglo-Iraqi Treaty of 1930, and British troops departed in 1937. Under the terms of the treaty, however, Britain retained the right to use Iraqi facilities in the event of war. In turn, Britain supplied equipment and advisers to the Iraqi armed forces. Britain controlled Egypt in roughly the same way after the Second World War, with the withdrawal of British troops, except in the Canal Zone and on the proviso that the British can pretty much return when they feel like. And obviously this was all upset by the advent of a nationalist leader, Colonel Nasser, to power. Iraq was of considerable strategic importance to Britain, writes Srinath Raghavan. For one thing, there was oil. Pumped from the British-controlled fields in Mosul and Kirkuk, Iraqi oil flowed through the pipelines to the ports of Haifa in Palestine and Tripoli in Syria. Moreover, the Iraqi port of Basra was the principal outlet for the main Iranian oil fields owned by the Anglo-Iranian Oil Company just across the frontier at Abadan. The Middle East accounted for only 5% of world oil production in 1941. The United States produced 83%. Yet American neutrality and German ability to interdict supplies crossing the Atlantic lent great importance to the cheap oil coming out of the Middle East. Later in the war, President Roosevelt made a personal visit to see Ibn Saud, the King of Saudi Arabia, and made all sorts of arrangements that America would have first refusal on Saudi oil in perpetuity. The stats here are actually quite illuminating about how little Middle Eastern oil accounted for global oil supply in 1941. This, of course, radically changes after the Second World War, and it radically changes after the Second World War mainly because of the huge expansion in living standards throughout the First World, particularly, and throughout the Third World in the 1960s and 70s. This thirst for oil, it really represents this vast kind of expansion in driving and aviation, in oil-fired power stations, and the like. By the same token, if these oil fields fell under German domination, writes Srinath Raghavan, let alone control, it would deal a huge blow to Britain. So Iraq is at the epicentre of a resource war that is being fought. The German war machine exceedingly hungry for oil. And up until this point, if you read Sean McMeekin's book Stalin's War, he makes the point that up until obviously the advent of Barbarossa, one of the reasons for the deterioration in Nazi-Soviet relations is the fact that Stalin so clearly has the Nazi Germany by the throat when it comes to the supply of oil. Hitler doesn't seem to have been that concerned about diversifying before Barbarossa. For example, the plan to interfere, as we shall find out about, the plan to interfere in Iraq seems to be almost one of the kind of Nazi Germany sort of fishing expeditions to see what can be achieved, whether it's possible you might be able to cause some serious inconvenience for the British. There doesn't seem to be that much focus on seizing the oil fields in order to replace the oil from the Soviet Union that Nazi Germany is dependent upon. All the evidence points towards the idea that the way Hitler saw things was you quickly you wage a lightning war against the Soviet Union and seize the oil very, very rapidly, obviously before your own reserves run out. Moreover, Iraq was an important link, writes Srinath Raghavan, to imperial communications. It provided a land bridge from the Mediterranean to India, a route that would be of great value in sustaining British forces in Egypt if the Suez and Red Sea routes were closed. British air bases in Iraq, especially at Habaniya and near Baghdad and Shaiba near Basra, were important stops on the air route to India, the Far East and Australia. Obviously, in our time of being able to fly non-stop from London to Sydney or from LA to Singapore, we forget that people like Churchill and Roosevelt, when they did head to international treaties, were often in a kind of fairly uncomfortable uncomfortable and cramped flying arrangements. I think Churchill had been in a number of Lancasters, and they had to be stopovers for fuel. You have to have stop off places because of the range of aircraft at that time. So Iraq's really important for a number of reasons, and of course it's having the problem that the British Empire faces throughout its final years of kind of resurgent nationalism. From the standpoint of India, the Viceroy of India, Lord Linlithgow, and the Chief of General, the Commander-in-Chief in India, Claude Auchinleck, Iraq was important on the two more counts. Firstly, it was an integral part of the external defence strategy of India. Not only did Iraq border Iran, but controlling the mouth of the Persian Gulf at Basra was regarded as indispensable to the wider security of India. As the Chief of Staff put it, if Iraq and Iran become subservient to the Axis powers, our enemies would be at the gates of India. Second, developments in Iraq would inevitably impact on the Arab littoral states and on Saudi Arabia, which all fell under the Raj's sphere of influence. In particular, India's ability to use the area from Bahrain to Kuwait would depend on a friendly regime in Iraq. And so, again, it's really interesting to think of India that hadn't got dominion status within the British Empire, wasn't like Canada or Australia, having its own spheres of influence. That and we can think of India having its own, India as a direct colony of Great Britain, having essentially its own foreign and strategic policy. Obviously not run by Indian politicians, run by white British viceroys and commanders-in-chief, but still having a distinct strategic outlook that isn't entirely similar to that of the British Empire, and able to take decisions that are semi-autonomous and devolved.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Just, of course, as long as Indian politicians, the British government is satisfied that Indian politicians, Indian nationalist politicians, aren't really part of that process. At the outbreak of the war, writes Srinath Raghavan, Iraq was ruled by a pro-British regent and an equally well-disposed government. Prime Minister Nuri al-Said promptly accepted British demands to sever diplomatic ties with Germany and provide assistance to Britain. The alacrity with which he acted gave a handle to his opponents. Britain's role in the affairs of an ostensibly independent Iraq was already a rallying point for the opposition. The Palestinian problem provided another. The presence in Baghdad of the exiled Mufti of Jerusalem, Amin al-Husseini, further fueled anti-British and anti-Jewish politics. The opposition included a group of four senior colonels of the Iraqi army, known popularly as the Golden Square, who were fired by the vision of a pan-Arab state and harboured pro-Axis sympathies. Here you find that the pro-Axis sympathies that you get under Arab nationalist leaders, the later Prime Minister of Egypt, Anwar Sadat, was a Nazi agent in Cairo, and there was widespread antipathy, or loathing, really, of the British Army in Egypt. And probably if ordinary Egyptians had to put up with white British soldiers behaving in a typical manner, as you can imagine, they would have been hugely unpopular. The British had been in Egypt since 1882 and had been generally enormously disliked by the locals. And so there is across this region, which is simply the Arab parts of the Ottoman Empire carved into states in 1919, with the exception of Egypt. Egypt wasn't carved up at the Paris Peace Conference, for the benefit of the British and the French, for the most part, who, of course, squabbled and behaved generally very badly towards one another in Iraq and Syria. The yearning for a kind of a pan-Arab state is immense, and it's hardly surprising that in the post-war era, characters like Nasser eventually managed to achieve some degree of pan-Arabism across the entire region. That's a kind of story for another time, however. The extent to which pro-Axis sympathies among Arabs meant that the Arabs really shared the kind of Nazi views is very, very limited. I doubt it was based on that at all. And some kind of disingenuous reportage in recent years has tried to kind of link people like the Mufti of Jerusalem to the Nazis. And, he did go and he did visit the Führer, but it was a kind of very much a visit of pure convenience to see if there was anything that could be done to dislodge the British and Jewish settlers in Palestine, and whether the Nazi regime would be the regime to do that. The kind of I think it was the History Channel or something like that did a was the The Mufti, and therefore the PLO, the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, was, I think, Yasser Arafat's grandfather. Were they therefore Nazis, and then therefore is kind of Arab nationalism sort of like Nazism? And it's like, well, no, obviously. It's of course not. Nuri al-Said initially tried to balance his pro-British policy with pan-Arab politics. Writes Srinath Raghavan. Unsurprisingly, he failed, and he was replaced by Prime Minister Rashid Ali El-Galani in March 1940. A former lawyer and judge, Rashid Ali had opposed the government's unconditional support for Britain's war effort. The subsequent course of the war seemingly confirmed his belief that Britain's hegemony in the Middle East was on the wane. In June 1940, when Italy entered the war, he refused to break ties with Rome. Rashid Ali was also reluctant to acquiesce to Britain's demand to allow its troops to pass through Basra to Palestine. Most importantly, he opened a secret channel of communication with the Axis powers. In shaping Axis policy in the area, Germany allowed Italy to take the lead while reserving the right to take its share of Middle Eastern oil. The Italians were eager to supplant the British in the region and had no interest in the independence of the Arab states. The pan-Arab pro-Axis politicians in Iraq had to satisfy themselves with a joint pro-Axis joint declaration by Berlin and Rome in October 1940, which really expressed full sympathy with the Arab cause. One of the propaganda lines that fascist Italy and Nazi Germany came out with was that Britain was a terrible imperialist, and that which, you know, given subsequent events, rather takes the biscuit for a kind of rank hypocrisy, but that the arrogance of the British had meant that the world had been carved up exclusively for them, and it was time now for a resettlement of colonial affairs. Hitler's not really interested in Middle Eastern or African colonies. He's interested in oil, but obviously his interests are in colonising Eastern Europe and Russia. I think Hitler was happy to leave what he viewed as large tracts of sand in the hands of Italy, as long as they could have the useful raw materials that came from there. The German Foreign Office felt the Arabs were a tremendously important power factor, but their utility should not be overestimated. We have no reason at all to be sentimental about these people, who are basically anti-European and torn by religious, family and tribal differences. The British began leaning on the regent to rid them of Rashid Ali, but the attempt to prise him out of power went awry, leading to the bloodless military coup by the Golden Square on the 31st of March 1941. Rashid Ali was reinstated as Prime Minister, and the regent took refuge in the American legation in Baghdad. By the way, for clarification, when Srinath Raghavan is talking about the regent, he's talking about Faisal II, who was Faisal of Iraq's grandson, who was later murdered in a violent coup in 1958. The British were obviously preoccupied with the campaigns in and around North Africa and the Mediterranean. The problem here is that Iraq, there are precious few troops to send to Iraq. There is the question of preparing a task force from India and landing it in Basra. This requires the permission, almost the kind of the cooperation of Rashid Ali, and they have to do a very delicate political dance there, because this, you know, is going to inflame nationalist sentiments. There seems to be no good reason, no justification for landing a force from India, other than the suspicion that the British might lose Iraq to the Axis. As we'll see, and I'll be doing another podcast on this one, The British feared that, or they intercepted intelligence that showed that Syria, which was in the hands of the Vichy French regime, would be the staging point for either a German intervention in Iraq or a route by which arms and other assistance could be smuggled into Iraq to help facilitate some kind of uprising. And people like Auchinleck and particularly Archibald Wavell had been looking with mounting alarm at what was about to happen in Iraq, and they could quite easily see that the Axis powers could score a very easy victory over Great Britain using the forces of Arab nationalism in order to do so. So what I'm going to continue this one hopefully next week, because there are some, as I said, some really interesting dynamics here, and it tells you kind of a lot about Britain's you know, both sides' need for oil and communications to Asia, between Europe and Asia during the Second World War. But also it provides really valuable context for understanding various struggles over oil and European colonialism in the Middle East after the Second World War. And when we get onto James Barr's brilliant book, Lords of the Desert, which I really intend for us to kind of dig into in the next few months, that'll take us on quite a journey all the way through to the kind of the mid to late 1960s. How the British and the Americans basically were each other's worst enemies in the Middle East. Anyway, thanks for listening as ever, and I'll catch you on the next Explaining History podcast. Take good care, everybody. All the best. Bye-bye.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.